So if you're not really able to produce your products in a sustainable and conscious and humane way, you will not have a business in the future. So in the past, you had to be profitable to be sustainable. So you spend some of your profit to make your activities a little bit more efficient and sustainable. In the future, you will have to be sustainable to be profitable. You will not have a chance to compete, to be accepted by society, by consumers, if you don't have a solid, convincing, sustainable business model. And for that, I think capitalism is reaching its limits, yeah?
Carles, welcome to the Conscious Consulting Podcast. I'm very, very happy to have you here as our esteemed guest. So you've been managing director of BASF Spain and Portugal until very recently. So you stepped back end of 25. You've been in this role since 2016. And before you had a long global spanning career in BASF dating back to 1989. Is this right? Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
That's right. But it's not like you spent all the time in Spain. So you serve leadership roles in Turkey. So you speak Turkish in Canada.
Well,
you're very good in English.
I used to speak Turkish.
And in German, your German is brilliant. I'm really impressed. So you have a very good global management experience and also overview, and we'll go more into this. And what I find especially interesting is that you hosted a sustainability and leadership podcast for BASF called Conversations for a Sustainable Future and invited people yourself. So you are already very well known and in this arena of sustainability. And we'll start by looking back a little bit and then also, of course, looking into the future and what the future holds for you. Even though you step back, you don't look like somebody who now goes into retirement and not doing anything anymore. But maybe we'll start by the question, can you take us back to your early days in BASF? So what was it like then as a young engineer, and what was your mindset about business and the world and purpose back then? How did you see the world in your early beginnings?
Well, Julia, first of all, thank you very much for this kind invitation to be part of your podcast. I'm very honored to be with you today. And yes, that was the year 1989. So that was the Barcelona, 3 years before the Olympics, very dynamic environment. BASF was taking in a lot of new employees, and I was fortunate to be one of them in a technical role in applications technology for plastics. And back then, my mindset was very simple, very, let's say, basic, because my first goal was to just get a decent salary from a reliable company like BASF, and to be able to do my job, to learn in the job, and to save for an apartment, because I was then already committed with my then fiancé, and we were just trying to build our common life. So that was the original setting. Strange environment back then, because we still had a lot of managers who followed the old style management playbook, and it was not especially motivating or inspiring, I have to say. That was the old times. Yeah. Then when I moved from the technical role to a commercial role 4 years after my entrance into BASF, I discovered that I was also enjoying the commercial role, so helping customers in different way, yeah, not just from the technical point of view, but also from the commercial side. And then when I really moved into my first leadership job at the age of 30, after also completing a master's degree at ESADE, that was the point when I really experienced the biggest shift in my mindset, because it was like moving from being self-centered and centered in the customers to being also focused on my team, yeah. And that was for me the best learning process, to realize that it was not just you, but the people with you, with whom you had to achieve results. That was for me a decisive learning point. And then also starting as a young manager the process of learning through all these formative and development actions that you can have access to in a big company like DSF, which provides a lot of opportunities to grow and actualize. That was, and of course, when after 4 years in this job, I moved to a different company within the BSF group, that was another shift, yeah? Because that was starting in a different environment and then learning different skills, new skills. And of course, having to prove myself that I could be successful as I had been before in a different environment. That was a nice challenge. I was not sure that I would really be able to do that, but I finally managed, yeah? That was the beginning, yeah?
What does make a leader a great leader?
That's a big question. I think there's no universal recipe for that. I can
no,
talk
we
about
want we want
my,
we
my
want
own,
your experience
my own
now.
experience. Yeah, my own experience.
I don't expect
so,
it.
In terms of, I do not know if you are familiar with this insights discovery framework, the colors, yeah, that show the main directions of people, yeah, the reds and yellows and greens and blues.
Yeah, but explain it a little bit for
yeah,
everyone.
It's just four colors. Reds are people who have this orientation to action, who are very driven, who just want to pursue goals and reach them. Blues are science-based, very rational, very technologically driven. Yellows are inspiring, are charismatic, good communicators. And greens are people who are centered on caring for other people, yeah? And in my case, and you can have different percentages of all four components. No one is really only blue or only red, yeah? In my case, I'm a blue-green, so at the same level, yeah? With my yellow and red components much lower, which means that I have this rational tendency to look at things from the scientific point of view. I am a chemical engineer, although I had this master's degree in sales and marketing. And that's the part that I used when I started with BSF, because BSF is a science and technology based company. That's what's expected from you, from a young engineer. And by playing out this component, you really can succeed in the first steps of your career. But then at some point you get these leadership responsibilities. And then my green component came to the surface. Yeah, I saw that just with rational approaches, I could not succeed. I could not really move my colleagues to advance together to the same goal. And I had to just resort to different strategies to just start listening to what they had to say. Before, we were just colleagues. It was a situation where I became the boss of people who were before my colleagues, my teammates. That was a challenging situation. Of course, you have to be very careful with that. But I think I could really manage to find this balance between becoming their boss and finding this closeness and also distance to act as their supervisor. And I think in the end, people they did, I think in all cultures, human beings expect the same from bosses, from their supervisors. They expect fair treatment. They expect to be seen and recognized and supported. They expect to be able to connect with others and to a higher purpose, yeah? And they expect opportunities to develop and grow. And if you, as a boss, provide all these components, I think you have a good basis to have a very, let's say, deep connection with your team members. And if you help with that, if you really put the needs of these people at the center of your strategy, then I think it's a good starting point to be a good boss. Yeah.
That sounds perfect. I heard a German brain scientist, and he said there's two basic needs that we have as human beings since the day we are really in our mother's bellies. Is one is to belong, but to grow at the same time. So
Exactly.
if we don't feel like we belong, we don't have the roots or the confidence to grow. But only belonging without the possibility to growing, if it's just so nice and easy, but there's no challenge, this is also not working. So we need to have both. So
definitely.
and this higher purpose, is probably something that was not so much talked about when I started to work in the 1990s, in the early 2000s. This was not a topic at all. I wasn't even questioning. I studied international business in Vienna and Los Angeles, and this was never coming up. And I think this is also changing, and maybe was always a topic that people said, I want to do something that makes sense.
Sure. No, you really have to behave as the leader of the organization wherever you are, and you have to make decisions, and you have to show direction, and you have to provide a vision everywhere. If you really want to help people to help the organization, and you show yourself as someone who really is there to support, to make the organization grow, people learn that about you and then start trusting you, regardless if you are a Spaniard or another nationality. So for me, it was, and you have to show yourself also in a humble way at the beginning. So you have to show up thinking that you have to learn new things, that you have to understand the environment before you are able to give directions. So there is a period when you blend into a new country, in a new organization, where you really have to be very, very open to novelty, to new ways of speaking, of relationships, and to be able to absorb that, yeah, to be a credible part of the organization. And if you're one of those who come with very solid convictions about what to do, how to do it, and you just start imposing your views and not taking into account what's there, then you will clash with the existing values and organizations. In my case, I was very humble. I always suffered from a little bit of imposter syndrome. Yeah, I always thought when I was promoted to a new job that I was not apt for the job. Yeah, I was even surprised that they would promote me to this to these responsibilities, because I did not see myself as capable of doing it, those jobs. So when I arrived, I was really terrified. Yeah, I was very, very nervous, and maybe that helped me to be very, very humble and very prudent. Yeah, I'm not the one who will teach these people what to do from the first moment. I just need to learn what is needed to function in these new environments. And I think this is a basic attitude to be able to learn and to understand what are the main pillars of that culture, of that organization, before you can really integrate them into your own strategy of leading. Yeah, that's what helped me a lot.
We see that the imposter syndrome, actually my last podcast was especially about this imposter syndrome and negative self-talk and the question how to deal with it. And the interesting experience is that the higher people are in a position, sometimes the stronger this feeling of not being good enough is coming up. And I always tell my clients, maybe they should trust people who select them. That they
Yes,
know
of
what they're
course.
doing in some sense.
Very true.
And we see different responses to it. One is, as you say, is to go into a position of learning and being and see it as a humbling experience and listening. And others, maybe people who have more red in their personality trait, might have the tendency to overcome it by starting to be like I'm the strong man, right? So imposing and being very fierce in the attempt to appear confident, more confident than they are, maybe overconfident, and then get a lot of backlash. You said maybe we look now a little bit from the leadership and the cultural differences into the question of the conscious part that developed in you this awareness of the planet, the environment. Topics such as sustainability. And you told the story about how, through your son, you had a very strong insight that somehow impacted you and helped you to de develop a different attitude and then a new way of working and doing until the podcast and so on. So I would like to ask you to tell us what that was. The people haven't seen you before. And then we will, unroll it from there, unwrap it from there, the
Sure,
topic.
sure. No, that's something I had not actually realized until much later that that was kind of a seminal moment, yeah, for me. So we were in Canada. That was autumn 2015. My son had just started at the university, Waterloo University in Ontario, and he had just spent a couple weekends in the university in the residence, and he just came back and told us to our surprise, my wife's and my surprise, that he had quit eating beef. And we were really shocked because he was a high consumer of hamburgers and steaks and things like that. And the reason for that is that as a part of their homework, they had been asked to watch a documentary by the name of Cowspiracy, which back then was new in Netflix. You can still find it in Netflix. Now it's very popular. And after watching that documentary, he had decided that he could not really continue eating beef for its impact in the environment and the depletion of resources and the pollution of the environment. And I was very impressed because I didn't expect him to make such a radical decision to prevent himself from enjoying this kind of pleasure that he had been so addicted to, just by sheer awareness of something that he didn't know about before. Then, of course, I watched that documentary with him. He explained to me all his concerns, and that planted a kind of seed in myself. So I did not quit beef then, but I quit meat altogether in 2017, 2 years after that. But he really put me on a path of self-reflection, of considering parts of my understanding of the world, how it works, and what the role of a company like BASF was that I did not consider before. So until then, I had been, you could say, a kind of a very obedient corporate soldier. Yeah, I had, of course, internalized and absorbed all the corporate messaging, which is, for its most part, very reasonable. And I had not questioned if this was the whole truth. And all of a sudden, I started reading books, watching more documentaries, listening to experts, really trying to self-teach myself about all these topics. While in Canada, I read a book that really influenced me a lot by Naomi Klein. This Changes Everything was the name, which was the first book where I read about the extent of the climate emergency. And this really opened my eyes to a whole new world, which for me was shocking, because then I could see the connection between the activity of companies like BASF and many others. BASF is not the main contributor to many of these problems by far, but the connection between the human economic activity and its impact on the planet and on the environment. And that set me on a path to learn. I was for some years really just reading about this topic, really absorbing everything that I could to refine my thought. And my thought has been changing ever since. So if I look back at where I was 10 years ago, because we're just in 2026, it's just 10 years ago from this conversation, yeah. I have gone through many, many phases. I have been putting different pieces in the puzzle of my understanding. And of course, I don't want to claim that I have the whole truth by far, or I have any solutions or especially deep insights. I'm just much more aware of where we are as a society than I was back then. And I'm really grateful to my son, who is now, as of today, still working in sustainability and a very good expert in that. And really, I have very deep conversations with him because he's always up to the latest developments and research and concepts. And I keep inspiring myself from him.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how that insight impacted not only your thinking and your awareness and your personal behavior changes, but also in the way you maybe made decisions in your work environment? So what is the level of possibilities you have in the position as a managing director?
Sure. I think the moment you realize that people are the most crucial and important ingredient in the success of the organization. You have to really craft your strategy around them and through them. Yeah. Of course, you have to do your job in the company well. So the company has to produce, in the case of BASF, you have to produce chemicals, produce them in a safe and efficient way, and they have to be good products for their customers. So that's the let's say the necessary prerequisite that you have to always ensure. But to differentiate yourself in the way you do all that from other companies and have the support of customers with their orders, you have to find something additional. You have to put a layer of let's say human value onto all that. And you can just do that if you manage to create a culture in the company where people really understand what they are doing, what they're doing that for, what their role is in that big process of creating this value for customers, and have the chance to work with other people who are equally inspired and who share a common set of principles and values, which we all agree on, and have in this way a work environment where they can really produce their best work and thrive, yeah, and be happy with the way that the company approaches its relationship with customers, but also with them, with employees, with suppliers, with communities, with the authorities, and that's of course a tough work. Yeah, it takes a long time to put all the pieces in the right place for this culture to emerge and to thrive. And you have to do that by, I think, in the case of my experience in Canada, I started by the beginning. I assembled the management team. I told them, look, I think we should really try to find a mission statement for BASF Canada, yeah, which was not existing. So BASF at that time, in 2013, had a global claim. We create chemistry for a sustainable future, and all of them were quite surprised at the beginning that I was asking them to be part of this process to create this Canadian mission statement, and we then embarked on this process of trying to distill what we were there for, yeah, and asking all of them to reflect on what was the capability of the company in Canada that would make us successful, yeah. And well, that was a very interesting starting point, because once we had the mission statement, we could then transform it into a kind of communication actions that reached all the corners of the organization, and to put it in coffee mugs, in posters, to use it in town halls. And then try to ask everyone to adapt, to distill that common mission statement for the company to their own work. Yeah, and this gave the whole community in the company a new way of understanding what we were doing. Yeah, I think it was the first step in a process of giving people more confidence, because as a chemical company, we have always suffered from a little bit of, let's say, feeling that we are the bad ones in this movie, yeah. So the chemical industry has always
the
been very much
criticized, and
exactly criticized, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were for many, many decades actually part of the problem, yeah. Nowadays, I think where the chemical industry is by far much more a big part of the solution, not just of the problem. Of course, we still have impact on the environment. We consume finite resources. We take water, we take minerals, we take fossil fuels, and we produce waste and emissions. That's like many other human activities. But chemistry also creates solutions which can benefit society at many different levels. And this part of the contribution was not highlighted enough, yeah? And by creating this mission, this sense of purpose, I think people really gained a higher self-confidence in the work they were doing. Yeah? And they were ready to put more effort into making that vision, which was aspirational, a reality. Yeah.
What was the vision? Can you share it with us? What what you came up with? You
Well,
still.
it's a variant of this We Create Chemistry. It contained the components of Canada, which is very important for Canadians. They are very, very proud people. They really display the flag everywhere, and they really have this pride of being a very, let's say, independent and high-minded country and people with sustainability and with customers. I think these were the three elements, yeah. And it was something like I would need to look up the formulation. There was a long sentence, which was like, "We create chemistry." Let me think. I'm not really because I'm not remembering that exactly, because we have then developed a new mission for BASF in Spain, which was, and this one has taken my mental space.
Of course,
It's
yes, no problem.
I can mention the mission that we created in Spain, which is "Estamos aquí para crear química sostenible y crecer contigo," which means we are here to create sustainable chemistry and grow with you. Yeah, which is not very different from the general statement, but this one has two elements which are very important. The first one is we are here. It's not the big BASF out there in Germany or wherever. It's the BASF in Spain and Portugal, which is close to you, and you know us, you know our people, and we are here to help you and to create sustainable chemistry. Sustainability must be part of the mission statement, and grow with you. And this grow with you is meant to be, let's say, not just customers, which of course they are in the first place, but also suppliers and employees, communities, and all kinds of stakeholders. So this grow with you means let's develop ourselves together, yeah. And then we just combined the whole mission statement into words, aquí contigo, yeah. So hashtag aquí contigo, so here with you, yeah. And this was also used in a very profuse way across our communication, and really created the same kind of hype of excitement that I had experienced in Canada. And it works like a kind of superpower. So once you have this mission statement, you see how people really get a brighter spark in their eyes, yeah. So they their sense of belonging with the company, of being aware that they do something of a higher purpose, is very motivating. So
Yeah.
some people believe that more than others. Some people identify themselves more deeply with the mission statement than others, but in general, the effect is very positive. And then, of course, you have to talk about your values and principles, and you have to make people understand that whatever you will need to decide, it will never be against those principles. So it will, and sometimes it's not so easy. Sometimes you discover, for instance, that a line of products that you have been selling for decades, which are very profitable, show now kind of negative impact on a certain part of the environment, which you didn't know before. And then in that case, what do you do? What do you do? So for us, from this new point of view, there's no question. So if a product that is produced by us is having a negative impact on people or on the environment, you have to remove that product from your portfolio. Maybe you can do that overnight because you have to take some precautions, but you have to be very decisive and clear about the need to remove that hazard, that risk from the environment. And this just is leaving your purpose. You cannot afford to just go about your business as if nothing would happen. And this kind of coherence between what you predicate and what you do is what gives people trust in all levels within the company and outside the company. Yeah.
So you have to make these tough decisions that even though a product line is very profitable,
Of course. Yeah. Yes.
you don't continue it in this way because you become aware of the negative impact it has. And instead of not being aware and not caring, you suddenly are aware and care. I think both
Yeah.
parts are really important.
Exactly.
Just being aware but not to care also won't make a difference than bottom line. So you are you were able to make these tough decisions. And I think now we're coming to the point where I see with my clients and people I talk to, sometimes the problems come. They say, I would, for example, in this example that you just gave, I personally would close it down, but then my shareholders or the board of directors, they will hold me accountable, and their focus is maybe really only the profit at the cost of whatever. So how do you argument it, and how can you follow
I
through with
think
these decisions and defend it?
luckily BASF has also evolved a lot, as many other big companies, in the way they think, and they have come to embrace these kind of tough decisions. So we have had many, many examples of situations where BASF has taken the right choice, the right decision, in my opinion, because there is this higher level of principles in the company, in the management, and it has not been difficult to show that something needed to change. Once we had new information that we had not known before, then it was the time to make a different approach, to take a different decision. So it was not such a big deal for me. It was maybe the thing is, you start, you discover, you uncover these situations in your own market, and then you have to elevate them to the management with the expectation that they will follow suit and they will follow your advice. And I have never had contradictions between what I was proposing and what was finally decided.
So it was in line. Probably
In
you would
line,
not have stayed there.
yes. So, of course, there are other instances where you have more decision power in your own sphere of management. I remember a situation in Canada where we had a small incident. A reactor just had an overpressure, and so partially, so I would not use the word explode, but the lid just popped off, and then there was a small release of product into the environment, and we had we just showered the neighboring homes around the factory with some let's say innocuous product, but it was concerning for them because it was like kind of snow, and then there were some, let's say, recommendations not to involve too much, just solve the issue. And I didn't see that as the best approach. I really wanted to explain to people what had happened with all openness, and just go. And we just went door by door, so neighbor by neighbor, explaining what had happened, that the product was not dangerous, what we would do to prevent that, and also be open to the community, to the emergency responders, to the press, to explain just what had happened. So not just hide it, cover what had happened. All human activities are subject to risk. Chemical industry is very good at managing risks, but sometimes some things can happen, and it's in those moments when you really show how much you care about people's concerns. And by addressing those concerns head on, by explaining exactly what has happened, by listening to them, what are they worried about, by giving evidence and good data to the press, to the responders, to the authorities, I think you show yourself as a good citizen. You actually contribute to preserving your social license to operate, because you need the
Of
license to
course,
operate as a
yeah.
chemical industry, as a chemical plant. You need the permission of your neighbors to continue operating those plants. And if you lose trust from them, if you just give the impression that you're hiding things, that you're not uncovering everything, this trust dissolves very, very easily. And then things become much more complicated. So, and that's the moment where you really have to decide. So because there are always many options, and many of them are easier to execute than others. So, as you can imagine, going home by home to explain to a big neighborhood what happened was not the easiest way to do things. But they were really thankful for that. And I think it increased the trust in the company, this kind of approach.
That's a huge soft power, which is actually not very soft. It can be very hard when it shuts down your business. So what I hear from you is that you address the topic of sustainability on different levels. The one is of creating a culture of shared responsibility, maybe. And you show that you care about the people in the organization, outside the organization, by building that trust, talking to them, and also for the planet by making decisions that are good for the planet. And probably in the lo long run, also good for BASF.
For the chemical industry, safety is the paramount value, yeah. So you really have to do everything to make your operation safe. And this depends not just on good management practices, but on the actions of every single employee in the company. Every day, every moment they do something in the process, they can do the right thing or make mistakes. That's why you have to give people the safety, the psychological safety to raise their hands when they see something which is unsafe or could be unsafe in the future. Instead of just covering it up, they have to be free to just say, look, this is not working well. We should stop this process because this is going to be dangerous. Or this work that we're about to begin is not safe because we don't have the right instruments, yeah, at our disposal, or the right preparation, the right permits, yeah. And that really, if you give the people the sense that they are able to stop something, even if there is pressure to do that kind of work very urgently, and you give them the safety that they will be supported by the management if they raise their concerns about something which is unsafe, you send a very powerful message. And then on top of that, if you also tell people that they're not just responsible for their own safety, but also for the safety of others, that they should look out for others, for their colleagues, then the culture expands and becomes very strong because it's not just you. You could be distracted one day, and even without meaning to do something unsafe, you could still make mistakes. But there are many people around you who could just point out to your mistake and tell you, Carlos, you're about to do something which is very unsafe. Yeah, just don't do that. Yeah. So if you achieve this kind of mutual caring for each other, this is a very strong base for the company because once safety is given, everything else builds on that. Yeah, everything else can grow on a sustainable and solid base. So people today are much better informed than before, thanks to the global networks. You have access to many different sources of information, and you can really monitor what's being done. Yeah. A different thing is if we act upon this knowledge. That's a different question. But you're able to scrutinize and monitorize and really question everything which is done in all parts of the business world. So there is radical transparency in the business world today. And if you're not really consistent with your claims and your actions, you will be just discovered. Yeah. Easily by NGOs, but also by media, by your own customers, and this could be fatal for your reputation. So your reputation takes a long time to build, but it can be destroyed in just a matter of hours or minutes. Yeah, and that's why today is very important to be assertive, to really communicate all the good things that you do as a company without excessive hype. Yeah. And not diminish them because a company like BASF is doing many, many excellent things. Yeah. And sometimes in the current environment, there might be a temptation to not explain everything that we do because it could be seen as greenwashing, which is not. It's just communication of things that are real, are material, are really solid. But today it looks like if you're really very proactive in communicating your achievements in sustainability, you're seeing someone who is just selling news, yeah. And I think this greenwashing trend is also negative for companies. Many companies are doing excellent things with excellent teams and motives, ultimate motives, and they are not just explaining all that to the public. Yeah?
How do you see the future now of business? You're also part of conscious capitalismo consciente, conscious capitalism, this attempt to consolidate profit and people and planet is to promote a different way of doing business. Not saying you must not you can't do business anymore, or business people are the bad guys, but to see how can you make business still, but in a very responsible way, caring for people and planet at the same time. So are we shifting in this being the new mainstream and quite normal in the future? Is one question, and then I want to see also where you see your own role in that development in the next years.
I think there is definitely a trend towards more conscience in business. What I see is that this group of more conscious leaders and companies is still small. And I think there's studies that say that until 20% of a community do not change their way of thinking, there is no chance of having a complete reversal of situations. So we still are not reaching the critical mass needed to achieve a change in the bigger society. Consumers are getting smarter, better informed, and they ask for things that they were not asking just 10 years ago. So if you're not really able to produce your products in a sustainable and conscious and humane way, you will not have a business in the future. So in the past, you had to be profitable to be sustainable. So you had to you spend some of your profit to make your activities a little bit more efficient and sustainable. In the future, you will have to be sustainable to be profitable.
Yeah, that's
So
nice.
the
Yeah,
society will
good,
not
well
be.
said. Yeah.
So you will not have a chance to compete, to be accepted by society, by consumers, if you don't have a solid, convincing, sustainable business model. And for that, I think capitalism is reaching its limits. Yeah. So I really like the community of conscious capitalism. Although I think that the part capitalism is the part which is more under attack. So to me, it's kind of an oxymoron. Yeah. And I have
It
been
is,
talking about
yeah.
that with my colleagues. So capitalism is based at its core on the idea of scarcity and of making profits. And of course, you can try to give it a layer of consciousness, of awareness, which will benefit customers and people and companies. But the system itself is not good. So I think we're in a moment of disruption. So it's going to be maybe a long transition period. It's going to take years or decades, but in my opinion, capitalism is dead. Yeah. We have to move to a different system, a system where profit is not just the only KPI, where we judge companies not based on their EBIT or EBITDA, but also based on what they do for the world. What is their contribution to shared prosperity? Yeah. And the shared prosperity could be in terms of what they do for their employees, for their communities, for the environment, if they really manage to compensate their impact on the environment. So there, some companies have set themselves the very high goal to regenerate the environment in which they operate, not just have a negative bad impact on them, but to just compensate that fully and then create positive change so that the environment of that company benefits from the existence of that company in that place. Compared to before the arrival of this company, people around the new company and the environment actually are better off than before. This regenerative approach, I think, is the future. And for that, of course, you have to be able to make different decisions on your resources. You are not going to allocate a big part of your profit to shareholders. Because actually, as Patagonia says, your main shareholder is the Earth, is the planet. Yeah. You should be able to decide, okay, shareholders need to get compensation for their investment. Of course, no one denies that. Yeah, that's the basis of business. But then you have to be able to assign a significant part of your profit to other means. Yeah, we see companies in Barcelona, for instance, Ferrer, no, is a company which devotes 50% of their total profit to social causes, yeah, because they think that just that it's their contribution to social justice. This kind of new ways of thinking is what, in my opinion, should be the right way to drive business in the future. I'm not very confident because I think there's so much at stake here, and so many powerful, let's say, forces and mechanisms that will prevent that from happening until we reach a kind of dead end where we are forced with the reality. So we're just faced with reality. If we keep doing business along the capitalist rules for too long, we will just reach a point of no return. The effect on the planet, on the environment, will be so huge that we will have to just stop and say, look, this cannot go on like this anymore. And we will reach this change, this inflection point, not by design, not by preparing ourselves to change things, but just by sheer confrontation with reality, with a planet that cannot continue anymore with this kind of depletion of resources and consumption of resources. And one way or the other, we will reach that point. And I'm not sure if it's just 10 years, 20 years, 30 years away from us, but as of today, we still have a chance to prepare ourselves to change capitalism to a new system where things are looked at from a more holistic point of view, not just from the perspective of profit.
Of course, I love everything what that you say, and I'm 100% convinced that everything you say is exactly what's true and what's needed right now. And what I think is like people like me and colleagues like with Conscious Consulting are trying to support this kind of regenerative thinking. Also, because it's pure logic, it makes sense. You can't have infinite growth in a finite physical world. It's just impossible. I mean, even capitalism, even ideology cannot transcend physical limits and
Rules,
limitations.
yeah.
Although it's interesting that for many people, it's a weird and difficult thing to say, although it's very logic. I mean, it's clear. And to go from profit to prosperity and to look at holistic goals, I think that's so important to think about what's my positive contribution to people, planet, and the shareholders. And to not be happy with doing a little bit less harm, but to actively see the possibility that we could actually have a positive net positive impact on the planet, that we could give back more than we take.
Yes, yeah. Because otherwise, resources will deplete. So we're already consuming natural resources at a rate which is not sustainable. So we're consuming 1.8 planets every year, yeah, according to this global sustainability network calculations. So we are in ecological debt. By when we reach end of May or beginning of June, the planet goes into ecological debt, which means that we're consuming resources which will not be available for the next generations.
So we're already.
It's a kind of Ponzi scheme. So to pay for the current investors of our Ponzi scheme, we take resources. We have to attract new investors who provide money to pay for the first investors, and then those ones will be left without any compensation. Yeah, it's a kind of Ponzi scheme, and that's maybe a radical way to put it, but I think it's very real. Yeah. So if we continue like this, the new generations will just look back and ask us very pointedly, what were you thinking? Yeah, when you were doing all these kind of activities and making all these decisions, what were you thinking? It's obvious that you were thinking just on yourself, not about the future generations. Yeah.
Well, I think they already ask us.
Yeah, sure.
They
But
ask us, what are you thinking actually? And don't put it on us because our generation is now the one in charge. And don't put it on
Exactly.
us. And this picture, this metaphor of Ponzi scheme will stick with me. I think everybody can understand what it means. And I also don't see how anybody can deny it. And once you know it, you know, right? So
Exactly. Then you
how can
cannot
you?
not know.
You cannot not know anymore, and maybe there's a responsibility to know. Like you're looking at all the resources that are available right now. We're not in a time where very few people have access to information,
Yes, that's right.
so we don't have that excuse that we didn't know. You have to know. So as a last question, I think that was really a very, very powerful moment. Now I'm very impressed and moved by all you said. To hear it from somebody like you really gives me hope, because you are for sure a corporate influencer and somebody whose voice is being heard. And I think we need more of those voices. Also, senior people who have all the experience and the knowledge, and at the same time the power to drive change. How are you going to now continue? What's your plans for your next phase in your life? What's your purpose? What do you want to commit it to?
I'm just 3 weeks outside BSF, so I'm still in the phase of trying to think what I want to do. I have some things already clear in my head. I just want to keep being helpful to people, to friends, to colleagues, be it in my family, in my circle of friends, in companies, in NGOs, in associations, in communities, where I can share my experience and try to help them in some way. I see myself as a kind of advisor to companies now, not anymore in executive roles, but being part of boards where this independent vision and perspective is required to balance or to complement the property of the company. And I have been getting a training at ESADE for this kind of roles, and I found it extremely helpful and interesting. So I think that's a kind of role that I will enjoy doing. If a company comes and asks me to be part of their boards, that's something that is still not the case. And then I also would like to if I have the chance to share with new generations of leaders and students my insights about the state of the world and the climate emergency. And I have made it a mission, a personal mission, to try to open the eyes of this new generation that comes out from business schools, knowing a lot about business, but very little about sustainability or climate emergency, and to let them know that there's not much time to waste, that the frame, the window of opportunity is not large. We have, in my opinion, at the utmost 15, 20 years until we reach a point of no return. And this new generation of leaders who come from these prestigious business schools with a lot of training, they should be aware from moment one that they will be part of the solution. And they cannot do that if they are not aware of all these risks that we have in front of us, be it climate emergency, the use of AI, things like that. And I made it a personal mission to try to open their eyes as much as I can and to confront them with the reality, which I have seen in many cases that it's not the case.
Carlos, you are aware that there is an initiative called Global Alliance for Conscious Business Education, also governed by Konstantin Mudrag, where different business schools are like TU, the Technical University of Munich, the Politecnico de Monterrey, and also business schools in Barcelona and in Rotterdam, now starting with the idea to bring in already regenerative thinking into the business education, so that we don't have business students coming out with the mindset from the 1990s, when I started business, but with a mindset of this is the main job to be done right now, and already have this in mind. So I was asked to join the board, and I think this would be a perfect role for you too, so we could be together in this board, because they need people from the business side looking into this, because the associative members will be professors, will be universities. But also, I care a lot about the next generation and not bringing them in on the wrong route. I think it's
Exactly, yeah.
highest time. And there's a lot of interest from business schools in Africa, from business schools in Latin America. That sounds beautiful. And what are maybe the two or three main messages you would like to give that next generation?
I think it's of course the present situation of business and of the planet and society is dire, yeah, compared to where we were just 5 years ago, even with a pandemic, which was a total disaster for millions of people. Now the challenges are enormous, and I think it's good to my advice would be not to despair. Yeah, it's easy to just look at things and think that it's too much. I cannot deal with that. Yeah, and this loss of agency would be disastrous, as well as it would be disastrous to think that the world will be safe, but not by me. So it's just on others to do that. Yeah, to contribute. So I think there has to be a way to instill this kind of agency on people to let them think that they can do things by themselves in their own sphere of influence, because by addition of these individual actions and initiatives, something bigger can emerge. Yeah, as I was telling you before, so when 20% of a group change their view on something, then something major can change. Yeah,
Also, it's not
but we
always
have to act.
linear,
Yeah,
right? We have
it's not linear.
an
It's just
exponential curve,
exactly.
maybe.
The moment you reach this 20%, or I don't know, it's 15 or 25, then things start to change more rapidly in an
I think
exponential
it's even
way.
earlier. Sometimes
Even earlier,
it can
maybe.
even 10 or 15%.
Yeah, but you have to reach this critical mass, and to you have to be bold. You have to really be able to challenge the status quo. You have to be able to discern what is information and knowledge and what is misinformation. You have to keep your values and principles solid, because they will orient you in moments of chaos and confusion. Yeah, when things are very confusing and there's so many pressure on you to do something, you have to just retreat into yourself and look at what you feel is right, and then of course have this attitude of serving others. For me, servant leadership is the highest way of serving as a leader. Meaning that you have to have this long-term view on things, not just make decisions for the short term, and think in systems. Yeah, it not just for your own area of activity and for your own profit, but just at the big picture. And this big picture is more and more difficult to find, because people are losing their ability to think critically. I think this is one of the main qualities I would look for in the future leaders, the ability to think critically, which is being lost with AI now. Many people are just getting these results from ChatGPT, and they do not just think any further, and that's really going to be the end of some of these critical thinking processes. So that would be my suggestion. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, I think we haven't talked so much about AI,
No.
but AI asks us to become even more conscious about everything you said, our value, who we are, what we
Yeah.
really want, because otherwise we will just be influenced
Yeah.
and have no, as you say, and the other word that you said is agency. I think that's an extremely important term in the face of AI agents who are taking
Exactly, yeah.
agency away from us,
The
I think.
bad use of the word,
Yeah, no,
yeah.
but it's also it's really important. Yeah, Karin, I think we are coming to the end. We've talked quite extensively. Thank you so much for sharing your story, your insights, your learnings on so many levels, and yeah, sharing it with me, with the audience, with the next generation. I hope that a lot of people will hear this podcast, are going to hear you in the future. I really feel that you are embodying a perfect combination of experience and wisdom. We need both. And impact. That's amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks to you, Julia. It was a very, very pleasant conversation. It was also very nice listening to your reflections on the topics that we have discussed. So I'm honored to be part of this podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you. To be continued.
Exactly.